and welcome to one of our mini summer episodes of our For the Medical Record podcast run out of the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine here at Johns Hopkins University. Today, we'll be hearing from Zubin Mistry from the University of Edinburgh about the paper that he presented here at Hopkins back in March at our colloquia series. And that paper was titled The Problem of Monastic Gynecology, Reproduction, Religion, and Medicine in Western Europe Before 1100. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for joining us, Zubin. We're really excited to talk to you today and to share a little bit of your research to our For the Medical Record audience. But do you want to go ahead and start by telling us about the work that you presented at the colloquium, the paper that you shared with us, its main points, give us a little summary, all of that?
Sure. I'm guessing maybe you don't have that many medieval historians on. And among medievalists, I'm an early medievalist, which is a sort of a kind of more unusual qualifier. So just, you know, a really quick setting of the scene. I'm a medievalist who deals with three-digit dates, so roughly got to about 1,000. I sometimes get nosebleeds when dates have four digits. And in the wider history of medicine, so you know, in that kind of slightly old Eurocentric grand narrative of medicine from classical antiquity to biomedicine, this is a slightly awkward moment, right? It's end of the Roman Empire, but it's before university medicine. It's before some of the trappings or, you know, what was taken as indicative of professionalization. It's before the re-entry in this, that's how it's framed in this whole story, of systematized, much more theoretically inclined medicine from the Islamic world. So this is this sort of awkward period that used to get called the Dark Ages. It's the bit in the story where there was a kind of slightly patronizing, you know, meanwhile in Baghdad moment, right? And then, you know, you could, by the 12th century or 11th century, you return to Europe. So it's in this in-between bit, and that's the sort of my home turf. And I've come to the history of medicine really from the history of reproduction. And that's what my colloquium talk was really grappling with. And at the most basic level, my colloquium talk was thinking about the presence within monasteries, and I'm really thinking about male monasteries. There are, of course, female monasteries, which I'm very interested in, but I was really primarily thinking about men's institutions. The presence in these institutions of gynecological texts and reproductive medicine. And you don't need to be an expert in medieval monasteries to know that there is a sort of tension there, right? So, you know, you have monks on the one hand and gynecological texts, and also texts like herbals, works of pharmacy that have plenty of things to do with reproduction, with women's bodies, with menstruation. So how do we make sense of that? And this question, what on earth is this material doing in these institutions? I think, you know, my paper's thinking about that, but it's also thinking about why that's actually such a useful question to grapple with. And I think it's a useful question to grapple with because it forces us to think about the big picture of medicine in this period. So broadly speaking, medicine in this period is quite practically orientated, so it's less inclined to being theoretically systematized. It's amateurish. And what I mean by that is not that there aren't any doctors in the occupational sense, but the written medicine that survives is really hard to tie to them. And finally, it's monastic. And the so-called problem of monastic gynecology, which is a term that was coined by a historian called Peregrine Horden, is a wrinkle in that picture. Because if this medicine is really practically oriented and it's largely housed in monasteries, here's a problem because this seems really impractical. So my paper is thinking about how we might tackle this question and why, as I mentioned, why the question matters. Monasteries in this period are not these sort of socially isolated spaces. They are completely connected with wider society. They're entangled with wider society. They have all kinds of relationships with people outside the institution. So in the last two or three decades, the history of monasticism, it's basically a really vibrant, invigorated field, and also a field in which the way people think about monasteries has really changed a lot. Among many other things, people have emphasized the importance of social entanglements for these institutions. So these institutions are, they have all kinds, they require outside society to function. But the monasteries that appear in histories of medicine are these quite, in some ways, like dark, dusty, isolated spaces, and you've got kind of monks who, you know, in candlelight looking at text, and that is the background picture with which we've been trying to approach that problem. Whereas, in fact, we need to realign the history of medicine with the history of monasticism. In my talk, that was one of the things I was trying to do. And very broadly speaking, there were two things I wanted to sketch out. One was a big picture of how reproduction was relevant to the social entanglements between monasteries and wider society. Communication about reproduction was really normal, and communication in which monasteries or people attached to monasteries are interlocutors in these conversations. That is a very normal thing in these societies. And we need to fit medicine within this bigger picture of social entanglements, where communicating reproduction is in and having conversations about it that include monasteries is a very normal thing. So that's the first thing I was doing in the talk. And just the second thing, just very briefly, is thinking about the different sorts of variables that might have affected the culture of medicine in different monasteries. I think another thing that's come out of the history of monasticism is a real move away from homogenizing monasteries and recognizing the heterogeneity of monasteries. So another thing I speak about in the talk is the very different cultures of medicine that could be created and sustained in different monastic institutions, some of which may well have felt a little bit icky about things like reproduction and medicine, but others, there is various bits of evidence that would suggest that other monasteries had no such misgivings, basically. So the paper, I guess, is trying to evoke a picture in which talking about reproduction and doing things with medicine is an intelligible and potentially normal part of monasteries' engagement with wider society.
We appreciate the crash course, because people outside of academia do listen to this podcast, including my dad, the number one fan of this show. But and you did sort of hint to our next question in your first response. But if you could explain more about what led you to this research.
I first encountered just the presence of writings to do with reproduction, with trying to, you know, just to be really sort of granular there, we're talking about really, you know, all of the ins and outs of reproduction, trying to promote conception, dealing with the aftermath of miscarriages, etc. And I encountered the presence of this material in monasteries when working on my PhD, which became my first book, which looked at attitudes to abortion in early medieval societies. And in the main, this was a history of how a kind of particular minority or minorities of men in these societies construct abortion as a problem, and what makes abortion more or less problematic in different societies. So I'm thinking about law, thinking about different kinds of ecclesiastical action. And I didn't quite know what to do with medicine in that picture at the time. So I sidestepped it. I wasn't sure how to fit medicine into that picture. And there is one approach would be to treat the medical evidence as, these are the things that these other people are responding to. These sort of men in positions of power are problematizing. See, these are the practices we can see. And that's intelligible. But the really interesting complication is that, if I may put it like this, the medical text containing this material is circulating through the same networks through those other condemnations of abortion are also circulating. There's a sort of overlap in terms of the textual communities, the readership, the intellectual cultures that are talking about abortion as a problem are the same textual communities and intellectual cultures that possess these medical texts. There's a kind of overlap there. So actually there's a more complicated story that's going on. And I guess I've always been trying to think about it for quite a few years. And then after writing the book, I started being more broadly interested in questions of fertility problems, reproductive anxieties, how people deal with childlessness in these societies. And it became it's even more unavoidable. But in fact, interestingly, I think when I came to Baltimore for the talk, I was also in town for another workshop on the history of abortion. And I increasingly think that thinking about medicine and monasteries or medicine and religious institutions in this period is also going to be really relevant to thinking about knowledge about abortion in these societies.
That's great. Thank you. And it's kind of nice to hear that some of these questions, because I definitely have questions that I'm pushing to the side for the first book project. I'm like, I can't, that's overwhelming. I can't deal with that. It's nice to know that you can come back to these work on them later. We'll definitely come back to this question of abortion, but before we get to contemporary relevance, we love asking people if there was anything, you know, in the archive or, you know, with these objects mm-hmm. or within the process of conducting this research that really surprised you that you weren't expecting.
Yes. It's the finding the thing I thought I would never find. And I only found it when I'd stopped looking, of course. So there's maybe from the 10th century, I'm not quite sure, in the bottom margin of a manuscript. The manuscript is just explanations of terms from the Bible, something like that. This is kind of just a standard monastic educational text. But in the bottom margin of a manuscript, there's a prayer that looks like it's been written by a woman called Adhil Judis. And in this prayer, she's basically, as far as I can tell, expressing a desire not to be pregnant. So this is a woman's voice on unwanted pregnancy. And it's something I didn't expect to find. And there are all kinds of interesting questions one might ask about this. So there's questions about women in intellectual culture and writing. But of course, there's also questions about unwanted pregnancy. And I find the thing that this prayer has really made me alert to is how people... We sort of tend to conceptualize the relationship between religion and abortion as an antagonistic one with a lot of reason, but it's made me much more alert to many other areas in which different aspects of early medieval religion are relevant to how people cope with things like unwanted pregnancy.
And I just want to sort of piggyback not only off of your response, but also off of Christy's question about how, or actually before Christy's question, how this project came about organically, and like how you said, you stopped looking for something and you found something and you had questions that you want to come back to at a later date. But your work has profound contemporary relevance. How do you see this work and your wider research, historical work, relating to not only work issues around abortion, but any other issues or debates in medical practice today?
I mean, for me, but partly because I was in town for this History of Abortion workshop, I guess that's what's been on my mind, and it's, you know, such a huge electric part of the present moment, and it was very interesting coming to the US for as well, as somebody who's an outsider to the US. I think for me, I feel more confident about trying to think through the contemporary implications than when I was a PhD student. In a nutshell, I guess I think that a certain kind of moral negotiability has been a normal part of Christian tradition on abortion than is recognized. I think that, as I mentioned, this prayer written by this woman, Adhil Judis, is one of many examples I'm now noticing of how people are using the resources of, you know, Christian ideas, practices, to cope with unwanted pregnancy, also to try to effectively get rid of unwanted pregnancies as well. So there's a story, for example, from an early Irish hagiography where it's quite an unpleasant story, I should say, you know, and involves kind of sexual violence. There's a nun who's abducted by a kind of local king. King basically means like a mafia boss in this particular society. And the saint effectively recovers her, but, you know, she has been raped by this king and she's pregnant. And the saint kind of blesses her womb, and with the intention of doing this before, to quote the hagiography, the serpent seed comes alive. Okay, this isn't some, you know, this is, you know, at this point in this part of the world, in an early medieval society, this was completely intelligible and sort of a moral act, if you like. I'm not saying that is the entirety of attitudes to abortion, but the point is that has been historically part of the wider story of how people with Christian identities have thought about some of the challenges and problems posed by unwanted pregnancy, and also some of the challenges posed by patriarchal social structures, by sexual violence against women. So yeah, there's a moral negotiability, a kind of certain kind of flexibility, and also a whole set of uncertainties that have been a normal part of the history of abortion and Christianity. And that's increasingly something I'm interested in trying to articulate more decisively and confidently.
That's so interesting. Thank you for that. I love that phrase, moral negotiability, within religion and abortion. I think that's a really important term for thinking about it today and in the past. And I also really appreciate that story you just told about the saint and the blessing, because I'm pretty sure that Mary in her episode shouted you out for finding that. Yeah, for finding that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I like that little callback. That's quite nice.
And if you need a title to an article or your next book, Moral Negotiability is a great start.
Yeah, I really like it. I really like it.
I'm going to run all my titles by you two from now on.
Yeah. We got your back. That's it from us. Thank you so, so much for talking to us. It was nice to see you again. And hopefully, you know, we'll see you back in Baltimore sometime, or maybe Antoine and I can come up to Edinburgh. I've still never been. So
yeah, please do.